So Hare Krishna, good morning everybody. Welcome to Sri Sri Radha Kalachandi Srimad Bhagavatam class. Today is Wednesday, June 13th, and it's Amavasya. Deities are wearing black, it's the new moon today. Jaya Radha Madhava Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jai Radha Madhava Jai Kunjabi Hare. Oh, thank you, Maharaj. Gopi Janava Jaya Gidi Vadad Hare, Jaya Gidi Vadad Hare. Gopi Chana Valabhapa Jagiri Vadadhari Jagiri Vadahohari. Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana Yasoda Nandana Braja Jana. Jaya Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jai Kunjabi. Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jai Kunjabi. Jaya Jamuna Tiravana Chari Jai Kunjabi. Jai Radha Madhava Jai Kunjabi. Jai Radha Madhava Jai Kunjabi Hare. Jai Nityananda Parameshwaram Vishnupad Astu Tarvishu. Slavim grace. Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki. Nantikuti Vaishnavrinda ki. Iskan Guru Vrinda ki. Premsitakoshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Vaitagadad Harshavasati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki. Shishi Radha Krishna Gokopina Shamkun Radhakun Giddi Gopradan ki. Shishi Radha Kalachandi ki. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki. Premanandi, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories, all glories, all glories to the lotus feet of Shishi Guru and Gauranga, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this morning we're reading from the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter number 24, beginning with text number 20. And this chapter is entitled The Philosophy of Sankhya. So please repeat. Sarga Pavartate Tavat Purvaparyena Nityasha Mahan Guna Visargarta Stiti Anto Yavat Ikshanam. So there's two Sanskrit Sunday rules in this verse that I want you guys to see. In the second line on the word nityasha, there's an H there. It's an aspirated H with a dot beneath it. So you can repeat that S-A, which is actually like S-H-A. So you take that vowel and then you add it to the H. So it would be shaha. So that's just to get... So that the meter of the, you know, verse can be spoken. So that H, it's optional, but sometimes we need it. And then in the fourth line, you see the word stiti with the Y. So that Y joins with the next word, unto. So it'd be yanto. So it'd be, so the actual vowel, Sanskrit has, three-letter vowels a lot of times. So it would be sti, S-T-H-I, and then you take the T-Y and you join it with the next word, unto, so it'd be tyanto. You follow that? Okay, so it's not sti-ti unto, it's sti-tanto. So we're reduced, yeah, like tanto, like the Indian. Okay, so here we go. Sorry, I got a cold, so my sense is going to be a little choppy. It goes, Sarga Pavartate Tavat. Oh, Purva Paryena Nityasa Mahanguna Visargarta Stitanto Yavat Ikshanam. You guys want to try? Would you like to do it? Sarga pavartate tavat Purva paryena nityasaha Mahanguna visargartha Stityanto yavat ikshanam. Perfect. Thanks. And a good voice. Okay, so word for word. Sarga, the creation. Pavartante, continues to exist. Tavat, to that extent. Purva arparyena. In the form of parents and children. Nityashaha. Perpetually. Mahan, Bountiful, Gunavisharka, of the variegated manifestation of the material modes. Artha, for the purpose. Stityanto, until the end of its maintenance. Yavat, as long as. Ikshanam, the glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation and purport. As long as the Supreme Personality of Godhead continues to glance upon nature, the material world continues to exist, perpetually manifesting through procreation the great and variegated flow of universal creation. Purport. Although the Mahatattva, impelled by the force of time, is the ingredient cause of this world, it is clearly explained here that the Supreme Lord is personally the only ultimate cause of all that exists. Time and nature are powerless to act without the glance of the Personality of Godhead. He creates unlimited material variety for the sense gratification of the conditioned souls who try to enjoy as the children of particular parents and as the parents of particular children throughout the 8,400,000 species of life. So in our verse today, here we're talking about the glance of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, you know, generally, like even old Noel Webster, right, from the Webster's Dictionary, he knew that God is omnipotent, right? If you look in the dictionary, you know, we're not talking about our definition, just the basic dictionary definition of God. We're seeing that God is the omnipotent, omniscient, creator, maintainer, and destroyer of everything, right? Even old Noel Webster knew that. So one thing we have to say is that if God is such a person, right, such a being, such an entity, that means that God is relevant to everything. You cannot say that God is irrelevant to something. That's a linguistic contradiction, because God is controlling, God is conscious, God is empowering, God is creating, God is maintaining, God is destroying everything. Right? We didn't create this universe. We're not maintaining it. Right? We can't create a company to recreate the sunshine. I bring this up a lot, but it's a very important preaching point Prabhupada makes, is that, you know, if you just look at the basic necessities of life, just like, you know, the air we breathe, it's so nice to breathe, right? Especially when you have allergies, like me. So we know, right, IBM didn't create the air. If you go drive by the IBM building over at 635 and 75 over there, it looks so insignificant compared to the idea of the air that surrounds this planet, what to speak of throughout this whole universe. Right? Or the sunshine. Right? Xerox didn't create the sunshine. You see? Or the systems that operate within our daily life, just like our water supply, right? It's an amazing function. You know, we have a huge saltwater oceans. The sun evaporates it. It goes up into the cloud, up into the sky as clouds, right? Clouds literally hold tons and hundreds of tons of water and floats that water through the sky over the land, and then everything becomes nourished, right? And our rivers become full, and our lakes, and we have drinking water, and our food grows, and then it pours back to the sea. It's a perfect ecosystem. Right? You don't have to change it. It's already perfect. So, you know, anything, you can bring up anything, you know, the metal we use for our electronics, the wood we're using for our furniture, you know, the simple ability to see, to speak, to think. All of this is going on by the arrangement of a higher transcendental power. This is a scientific fact. This is not faith. We are witnessing this empirically with our own senses, that we are being maintained and controlled by a higher transcendental power that's far beyond the ability, you know, of man to reproduce. Like, we can't create a company to recreate the sunshine. So we have to admit this. It doesn't matter who you are, what your religion is, what your education is, what your social position is. It's a simple fact of life that there is a higher power that's controlling us and maintaining it. Well, you could say, well, I don't see that, right? I don't see the higher power, right? Well, I'm pointing out that there are definite indications that there, you know, that are functioning within nature that you can see with your own eyes. And people say, well, you know, I don't see the law of karma, or I don't see a creator, right? Well, you might not see the law of gravity either, but if you go up on top of this building and jump off, it still works. Right? Just because we don't see something doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. There's so many things, like even on the other side of this wall, that we don't see. Does that mean nothing exists there? So the point that I'm making is, first of all, we have to accept the simple fact that there is a higher power, whether you want to call that higher power Krishna, or you want to call it, you know, the origin of life, or the origin of creation. You have to admit that there is something out there, you know, that exists, that is controlling, maintaining, and creating everything. We know we didn't create it. We know we're not in control of it. You know, this whole Western worldview, this whole paradigm that there is no God, there's nothing in control of anything, everything happened by chance, it's just a source of so much anxiety and stress and confusion. Right? Just like if you say, well, we know we're not in control, right? Right? You're not controlling the sun coming up and going down, right? You're not controlling whether it rains or not. We're not controlling. We can't even control the hair growing out of our heads. People want to say, well, I'm God, I'm the supreme, right? Everybody is God, right? God's the supreme controller. You know, wouldn't it be nice to just save a little money at the salon? Right? Just stop your hair from growing, right? Stop from getting old. Stop from things happening in your life that you don't want to happen. You can't do that. You have to admit that you're not the supreme controller. So most people that are a little sensitive, a little intelligent, they understand, well, I'm not in control. And then if you accept this, you know, Western worldview, so-called scientific worldview, that nothing is in control. Well, if I'm not in control and there's no God in control, that means everything is out of control. So if everything's out of control, that's just a source of anxiety for everybody. That's why people are so stressed out, because they don't understand these subtle laws. They don't understand the law of karma. They don't understand that there's a supreme controller. They have such a poor fund of spiritual knowledge. Even, you know, mainstream religions today are advocating that there is no God, or that God is just some type of energy, right? A faceless energy. And yet we're being told to love God. Like when I grew up in Catholicism, okay, so the picture that they showed me of God was of an old man sitting on a throne with a blank oval for a face. That's casting people into hell. Right? So here you are, you know, you have desires, you have aspirations, you know, you want loving and intimate relationships and friendship and excitement and adventure, you know, and that's like a bucket of water, you know? And then they're telling you to take that bucket of water and pour it into the blank oval, right? Which is like a foam cup, right? It doesn't fit. You can't take the heart of your heart and love a blank oval. It doesn't work. So you see, most intelligent people, you know, they just don't accept that. They don't agree with it. They don't, they don't buy into it. And then you've got these atheistic, scientists and even religionists that are agnostics, you know. They don't believe in the existence of God, nor do they believe in the non-existence of God. It's just nobody's ever proven it to them. That's what it means. And so our education system, you know, it takes advantage of that because, you know, people want a license. We want to be independent. We don't want anyone to tell us what to do, right? Like in America, you know. We have that, you know, who are you to tell me what to do? Even if you watch a children's cartoon, right? If you do a simple sociological study and, you know, even you turn on a children's cartoon, you know, you'll see things like, you know, a child riding a bicycle, right? And you'll hear this little song. Hey, kid, go ahead and ride your bike. Ride your bike wherever you like. Don't let anyone tell you where to ride your bike. It's all anti-authoritarian, right? Who are you to tell me what to do? I'm a free person, right? Freedom, we're fighting for freedom. You know, that gives me the right to do whatever I want, right? So, and then you've got things like, just a horrible situation. Okay, let's just look at it for a minute. So, you know, here we are being told, okay, you know, you shouldn't accept any authority unless it agrees with your sense gratification, right? Okay, so now here we are. You know, let's just say for a minute you've got a serious physical problem. You know, you've got a disease. You're going to die, right? So you relinquish your so-called independence and you accept the authority of an expert doctor. Right? Here you are, you know, you've got a legal problem. You're going to go to prison. You relinquish your so-called independence and you accept the authority of an expert lawyer. So in real life, this anti-authoritarian, you know, so-called freedom, you know, so-called liberation, it doesn't work. But why are we being told that? For sense gratification. Okay, I'm going to give you guys a new scientific theory. It's called the lusty boy theory. Okay, so just like you got a lusty boy, and he's in his house, and he sees a beautiful woman out in the street, right? So he's looking at her and he's thinking, oh my God, she is so beautiful. She should be for my enjoyment. Right? She has no father. She has no husband or fiance. She's meant for me. So in the same way, if you look at all of these philosophies and these science, so-called sciences, you know, that say that there's no authority, there's no ultimate controller, there's, you know, everything's meant for my enjoyment. It's just another way to fulfill your lust. Right? That means everything's for my enjoyment. And no one can tell me, you know, what to do. That's all you're dealing with. It's just like a lusty boy. That's why people are so, you know, fond of, you know, advocating all of these things, because it just gives me a license. Just like, you know, come on, guys. They say that in this universe, which there are literally countless planets, you know. I mean, when you look out there in the sky at night, especially when you go out in there into the country, they say that all of the stars in the sky are actually actually suns, you know, the planet sun, the sun planet, of different solar systems. Now, so if our solar system has what? Like, we've got like 10 planets in our solar system, right? The Earth, the Moon, Saturn, Venus, right? Mars, huh? Whatever, you know. Vedic is 7. And Western? Pluto? 9. Yeah, so Srila Bhakti Saranda Saraswati, Prabhupada's spiritual master, he gave the numerical formulas to the British scientists by which they were able to adjust their telescopes and see the planet Pluto for the first time. That's in Encyclopedia Britannica. You can see a picture of Bhakti Saranda Saraswati being accredited for that. So if every star is a sun, and every sun has 7 to 9 planets around it. So, I mean, just look up in the sky and tell me how many planets there are. And they're saying there's no life on any planet? That this is the only planet with life on it? And we are the most evolved form of life that's ever existed? And everything's meant for our enjoyment? And no, there's no supreme controller. There's no origin. Like I was talking about the other day, the Western speculation of creation is very similar to the Mayavadi philosophy in the sense that they do not agree that there can be a supreme person that's so powerful. That's just too far out. That's just too wild, you know, to say that there's an omniscient, omnipotent being. Practically speaking, our whole society is ridden, you know, it's just dripping with atheism. Okay, just like, if you look at Western science, what they purport is that, you see, they say that if you accept a creator or an origin of creation, it has to exist prior to the creation of this universe. Okay? So that means like when, you know, we were talking about this the other day, right? The meaning of the word transcendental. Were you in that class? So do you know what the meaning of the word transcendental is? I'm sorry, I forgot your name again. Jen? Chandra, thanks Chandra. Yeah, so, hey Chandra, do you know what the meaning of transcendental is? To go beyond something. Actually, it means, the English definition of transcendental means something that is not under the control of time. So, what they say is that, you see, if the origin of the universe is under the control of time, or if, like for a theist, if we say that God is under the influence or control of time, that would mean that when the universe is destroyed, God would also be destroyed. So if we accept that there's a creator, that creator would have to exist before or prior to the creation, right? Okay, so that would mean that the origin of life is not, or the origin of the universe is not within the universe and is not under the influence of time. So whether you want to say God or whether you want to say some primordial soup that the universe popped out of, right, from a sudden chance explosion, that's what they teach in universities that you pay $100,000 to get a degree from. Okay? So, that means, but what they conclude is that therefore God cannot be a person, or the origin of life cannot be a person, because to be a person, you have to come under the confines or the perimeters of time. Right? Like, just like, you know, to perform any action takes time, right? Can you explain to me an action that doesn't take time? Or a thought? A thought takes time. So when they analyze, you know, basically what it means to be a person, right? To have desires, to have aspirations, intelligence, thoughts, actions, you know, all of these things take time. So that means that the origin of life cannot be a person. Because the origin of everything exists before it, or free from the influence of time. You see how they conclude? And Mayavadis, what the Mayavadis do is they say that everything is one, right? You've heard it in so many ways, right? All is one. God is one. Just like the devotees went to a big program, and there was a famous Mayavadi guru there, and he asked the devotees, he asked the audience, he said to the audience, he said, why do you want to become Hare Krishnas? They're going to teach you how to become a servant. If you follow me, I will teach you how to become the master. And everybody started applauding. I've been to so many programs where the gurus and different persons that are presenting things say that, you know, ultimately you sit down, merge, and become one with God. And ultimately you are God. And everybody really, they all, you know, eat that up. They love to hear that. But what they don't understand is actually to be the servant of Krishna is much, much, much greater than being God. Because when somebody loves Krishna, they actually control God. Just like Mother Yashoda, right? She can tie Krishna up. So the servant, the lover, the friend of Krishna becomes even God becomes subservient. So if they want to be God, the servant is greater than God. Just like when you go to Vrindavan, right? Everyone's saying Jai Radhe. Why? Because Radharani is considered to be greater than Krishna because she controls Krishna. Krishna is called Madan Mohan, which means that he is the attractor of millions of Cupids. All of us are being controlled by Cupid. We're all being impelled by the attraction between men and women, right? And then, but Krishna is called Madan Mohan. He is the one attracting Cupid. And Radharani is called Madan Mohan Mohini. Maybe Parshuram Prabhu's daughter is going to get that name. Her name is Mohini. She's getting initiated soon, so maybe she'll get the name Madame Mohan Mohini. Right? So that means Radharani is controlling Krishna. She's enchanting Krishna with her love, with her service. Not by demanding that Krishna serve her. Right? Look, come on, guys. Like, just like if I start demanding from you guys, okay, I want you to do this. I want you to do that for me. I want you. You're going to just hate me. But if I try to serve you with love and friendship, who's going to tell you no? If you really sincerely try to help somebody and serve somebody and love someone, they're going to love you more and more for that. That's reality, not this insanity that we're all God. My Guru Maharaj, when sometimes the hippies would tell him, we're all one, we're all God, and he'd say, oh really, we're all one? Okay, then give me your wallet, because if I take your money and spend it, it doesn't matter because we're one. I mean, live your philosophy. Come on, guys. If it's all one, man, just sign over your bank account to me, right? What does it matter? Nobody's willing to do that. Nobody can live that way. And if they want to say that they're God, well, what's the proof? What's the test? Right? They can't control anything. Prabhupada used to say they cannot even control themselves from passing stool. And they dare to claim to be God. That is like reeking of false ego. Talk about a divorce in the works. So this scientific philosophy, okay, with the Mayavadis, what they're saying is they accept one aspect of God, that God is one, that everything is ultimately God. Okay, they accept that. But to prove that unity, you have to remove all duality. Right? If everything is one, if you want to create an absolute unity amongst for everything and everyone, then you have to remove all duality. So to remove all duality, you have to create oneness. All right, so 3 is closer to 1 than 10, right? If you have 10 things, so there's more duality there. So if you reduce it to 3, 3 is closer to oneness than 10. 2 is closer to oneness than 3, right? So ultimately, they take this idea of unity and they bring it down to 1, oneness. So there's 1 point, right? But then you still have the point and you have a background. So there's still duality. So what they do is they say void. So God ultimately becomes 0, nothing. That's where speculation leads us. That's what Western science is too. It's just wild speculation. Prabhupada said that religion without a scientific basis is simply sentimentalism, right? You have to believe. You have to love. Right? It's just sentimental. Why should I love? God has created so much, so many problems in this world. Right? If you say that God is controlling everything, why are children being born with diseases? Why is there economic problems? Right? So how can I love God? And people don't have any answers for that. And then you have the... religion without a scientific basis to realize the soul in God is simply sentimentalism. And science without an absolute truth is just mental speculation. Right? I went to a huge million dollar presentation done by, top people, Nobel laureates, huge waiting line, maybe 500 people in line to go in, and it was about the Homo sapiens, how we all come from monkeys, right? You know, when they asked Prabhupada about Darwin's theory, Prabhupada said, your forefathers may have been monkeys, but mine were not. It's a joke, right? It's funny. So I went to this thing, it was in Hong Kong, it was presented by the university there, hundreds of people in line to go in there and see it. And the first thing you do is you come in and there's a big picture of the sky at night, with all the stars, and this is how it starts.
3.2 billion years ago, dead inorganic matter went through a sudden chance explosion, and life began as we know it.
I mean, come on, 3.2 billion years ago, and sudden chance explosions, creating everything. I mean, come on, guys. One cell in our body they've been researching it for over 200 years, and they can't, with chemistry, they've been unable to even understand the simplest functioning of a cell. The simple functions of one cell. Okay? That means one cell in our body is millions of times more complex than our most advanced scientific communities. And they're saying that this whole universe just came out of nothing, with no intelligence, just a sudden chance explosion. That's insane. And we're sending our kids to these universities, to be trained up to be atheists. And what's the point? The point that they keep driving home is that religion is not a science because it's based on faith. What they say is that your scriptures are just a compilation of different statements, and you can believe it or not believe it, but there's no way to prove it. There's no way to put it to the test. That's what they teach. And they say that science at least accepts, logical perimeters and the guidelines of immediate perception, and it's verifiable through repeated, testing. That's what they say. But Krishna consciousness is different than that. We're not presenting simply a faith. We're presenting a spiritual science. Like I brought up the other day, if you look at the founders of modern science, right? Today, if you go to any university, they talk about the scientific age. We are living in the scientific age. Okay, so if you look at the founders of the scientific age, okay, there's three scientists. There's Galileo, there's Descartes, and there's Newton. And if you look what they present, okay, they present, for example, Descartes, he wrote a very comprehensive philosophy which is literally identical with Sankhya philosophy. He breaks down the material energy into 24 elements, and then he has a 25th element called cogita, which means consciousness, or he translated it, it's been translated as the mind element, meaning that desires, intelligence, perception, consciousness is different from the material energy. But he had no way to prove that. You see? So for about 200 years, Western science has delved into this mind element through what they call mental, there's a term they have, like introspection, mental introspection. But see, on the other hand, because they had no system to examine consciousness or to prove consciousness, in other words, you couldn't go into a laboratory and analyze consciousness, right? Like when you talk about scientific investigation, what are you dealing with? Okay, you're going to a laboratory, you're putting on one of those lab jackets, right? And then you're going in there and you're doing things with your hands, right? Like, you know, they take they'll take the cells out of a pig's skin, right? And they'll put it into a test tube and they'll pour acid over it and they'll break it down, right, into like basic elements. And then they analyze it with electronic microscopes. That's basically what's going on, okay? So when you're dealing with that, all right, there's no way to analyze consciousness like that. So after 200 years, that what they've concluded is there's no such thing as consciousness. And they say that everything is just a combination of material elements. Because see, they had a lot of success analyzing material energy using geometry. Right? That material things are can be analyzed in terms of the space and their shape, you know, that they take. So what they've done is, they've said, okay, everything is just a product of matter, and consciousness is just a combination of matter. And when matter comes to a stage where it can actually move, that's what consciousness is. And the movements of matter are known as the laws of physics, right? You guys have heard all about that, right? The laws of physics. So the laws of physics means the movement of matter. So basically, a person, okay, like just say, for example, you make a very simple stick person, right? So you draw a circle for a face and a line for a neck and two lines for the arms and a line for the body and two lines for the legs. Now, if that's, you know, no one would say, well, that can be ever conscious. But let's multiply that into, say, 10 billion lines. Just like Hansa Duda Prabhu is an artist. So when you draw a very complex picture of somebody, right, you use hundreds and thousands of lines, maybe a million lines, right? So that's what they say human beings are. A human being is just millions and millions of material lines. And when it moves, that's just a functioning of matter called the laws of physics. And that's all a human being is. And everything just comes from matter. Because They had no way to analyze consciousness. And that's basically what you're dealing with. And that's why the education system has become atheistic, even though all of our universities were basically instituted, they were founded, they were created to study scriptures. If you look at our universities worldwide, or especially here in America, like you have Southern Methodist University, but if you go over there right now, yeah, they have a department of philosophy and religion, but it's not considered a science. It's considered a belief. So what we're studying here is a science of consciousness, a science of self-realization, with a process of studying one's consciousness and through that understanding the supreme consciousness. Because we are part and parcel of that supreme. So the part has the same qualities as the supreme. But the difference is in quantity, right? We have our philosophy, achinta, beta, beta, tattva, that there's a simultaneous oneness and difference between us and Krishna, or the Supreme. So what we're stating here is that because we're part and parcel of God, we have the same qualities of God. We're conscious, we're loving, we have intelligence. But we are very small. So the yoga system is meant to allow us to withdraw our consciousness from the distraction of our material senses and mind and allow us to experience or explore our own consciousness. Basically, be ourselves for a change. Right? So that's what we're doing here. And by withdrawing ourselves and exploring our inner space, right? Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains there's outer space, and there's inner space. Okay, so outer space, you know, we're dealing with, you know, the earth and the moon and the universe and so forth, right? And consciousness can expand in outer space. But inner space, through the via media of our pure consciousness or through the via media of a pure heart, we actually have access to the spiritual world. Just like Prabhupada used to say, it seems like I'm sitting here in Los Angeles, but actually I'm sitting in Goloka Vrindavan. So consciousness can be removed from the modes of material nature, from the senses and sense objects, and it can be directed internally to the Supreme Lord. And what's really unique is that happens through the process of hearing and chanting the Srimad Bhagavatam, and ultimately Krishna's pastimes, if you do that in a way without offense. Because the offenses block our ability to perceive our soul and God. But just to make it very simple, like when you hear, say for example, Krishna's pastimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam, okay, there's three different levels of hearing that. So you can just hear it, right, and analyze it with your mind, okay? Then you can hear it and actually develop emotional love for the Supreme Lord, okay, called bhava. And then on the highest platform, you can actually enter within Krishna's pastimes through the via media of spiritual sound vibration. We have a lot of histories of our previous acharyas, Narottam Das Thakur, Srinivas Acharya. There's a beautiful books that are written about them where their bodies were in samadhi, their physical bodies were in samadhi, and through their pure consciousness, they were entering into Radha Krishna's pastimes. For example, there's one pastime where Radharani, she drops her nose ring into the Jamuna. And Narottam Das Thakur, and then one of Srinivas Acharya's disciples, who was an intimate friend of Narottam Das Thakur, named Ramachandra Kaviraj, they go in their spiritual bodies to Krishna's pastimes, and they look in the Jamuna, and they find Radharani's nose ring. But for 3 days, their bodies were unconscious. And for Ramachandra Kaviraj, I'm sorry, it was Srinivasacharya, Shamananda Pandit was in Samadhi, and Narottam Das Thakur was in Samadhi, and Shamananda Pandit's wife thought that he was going to die because he hadn't eaten or drank anything for 3 days. So they wanted to revive him. So the disciple Ramachandra Kaviraj comes there. He enters into Samadhi. He goes to and helps his spiritual master recover Radharani's nose ring. And then they return into external consciousness, into their bodies after 3 days. And there's a big festival. And if you study these histories, like they would, for example, enter into Radha Krishna's pastimes, like there's a holy festival. And they come out of Samadhi and their bodies are covered with the holy colors. Or once Srinivasacharya, he entered into Samadhi and he met Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He went into Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes and Lord Chaitanya put a garland on him from the spiritual world. And when he came out of Samadhi, he was wearing the garland. And the garland was so fragrant that the aroma, the fragrance of the garland wafted about his home for like a mile around his house. And everybody would come there and he hid the garland in his house because he didn't want anyone to find out what had happened. But the fragrance was so strong that all the devotees kept coming there. What is that fragrance? What is that fragrance? And finally they figured it out. And this garland, it stayed fresh for the entire life of Shamananda Pandit. It never wilted or became bad. It was made of spiritual flowers. So, when you hear the pastimes of Krishna, what's really unique is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes about this, and he explains that, these words that we're reading here in the Srimad Bhagavatam are spiritual, and one aspect of their spirituality is that Krishna is also conscious of us when we hear his pastimes. In other words, it's not just me, say, reading about, you know, baby Krishna breaking a yogurt pot, right, and Mother Yashoda tying him up, but when you read about these pastimes, Krishna is actually conscious, these devotees are entering my pastimes through their consciousness. You know, hey, Chandra is in my pastime today. Right? Hansaduta is in my pastime today. Bali's in my pastime today. He's thinking about me and Krishna's thinking about you. See, it's ecstatic. It's not just dead matter like I'm reading in some textbook, you know, about something atheistic. Krishna is all omniscient. He's conscious. So when our consciousness enters into Krishna's realm, into specifically into his pastimes, when we think about Krishna's pastimes, Krishna is conscious that we are there. And then as we develop our emotional love for Krishna, then our spiritual identity becomes more and more manifest. We become attracted to a particular associate of Krishna. And we begin to worship Krishna and relate to Krishna in the same way that that associate worships and loves Krishna. And our natural loving feelings for Krishna become awakened. That's what we're doing here. That's what all the deity worship's about. That's what hearing the Bhagavatam's about. That's what all this sense control is about. The sense control is meant to allow our consciousness to really manifest and, you know, for us to be able to recognize it. Just like recognize what our pure spirit soul is. Just like I'd been practicing for about 10 years and I asked my Guru Maharaj, I said, you know, it seems like I have more material desires now than when I joined. So he said, no, what's happening now is you're actually able to distinguish between your soul and your material desires. He said, when you first joined, you were so covered by your material desires, you couldn't distinguish between your desires, your material desires, and your spiritual identity. He said, just like the people driving by on the street right now, everything they're doing is being impelled by material desire and the modes of material nature. They have no realization of their spiritual identity. But as we advance, that identity becomes distinct from our material desire, from our the necessities of this material body to eat, to sleep, to defend. You see that? That's yoga. Yoga means to link with Krishna, with the Supreme. You see? I was listening to a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, and he was talking about how Krishna is Purusha, and all living beings are Prakriti, and Prakriti means female. He said, but that doesn't mean that our relationship with Krishna is just sex. He was saying that just because, he said, what it means, Prakriti, what it means is we are, by constitution, subordinate to Krishna. Meaning that we should be functioning in a way that pleases Krishna. You see? As soon as we hear male and female in the West, in our Western paradigm, we're always thinking of sex. But Prabhupada said that that relationship is actually a natural relationship with the Supreme Lord. Just like there's a natural relationship between a man and a woman. You can't change that. No matter how hard we try. That's why all people are so confused about their identity, because they're trying to, you know, they're trying to change the actual principles of nature. You can't do that. You cannot control nature. You cannot destroy what God has created. You cannot control what God has created. Man can control and change the things that he has created or she has created. But you cannot control or dominate or change what God has created. We don't have that power. So when we artificially try to become enjoyers, we suffer. But as soon as we take up that role of subservience to Krishna, Krishna, he's so, happy, so enthusiastic to relate with us. And actually, to be an enjoyer is not satisfying. Just like if I start demanding for you to serve me, right? You're just going to hate me, right? I already said that in class. So being a so-called enjoyer, which is not you, there's no enjoyment anyway. When you look at sense gratification, like if, say, for example, you have a graph. So you have zero in the middle, and then you go down, +1, +2 to +10. You go down, right? -1, -2, down to -10. Okay? So as soon as we try to enjoy sense gratification, right? So it's a negative experience. All right? Just like if you're hungry. Are you hungry? Because it's breakfast time right now. If you're hungry, okay, say you're a little hungry, it's breakfast, right, time, so it's like a -1. Or let's just say, for example, you're like one of those children in the Congo right now, you haven't eaten in 3 days, right? So you're starving to death, so it's like a -9, all right? So hunger is a negative experience, it's a need, it's a dissatisfaction. Now, if you try to enjoy and satisfy your hunger, okay, at best, you can bring yourself back to the point of zero where you don't feel hungry anymore. If you try to eat more than that, again, you go down. Right? You start getting indigestion. You can develop diarrhea. You can even kill yourself. I remember years ago, There was a famous Epicurean in Houston. She was a writer for the Houston Chronicle. She used to go from restaurant to restaurant and write articles about, you know, the restaurants, how good they are, what the food's like and everything. And one night, she had gone to three restaurants, and she ate so much food that she split her stomach open in the restaurant, and she dropped dead on the floor. And when they did the autopsy on her body, they said she had eaten 17 pounds of food that night. Or just like fish, you know, fish are considered to be lower, according to the Vedas, a lower level of consciousness than plants. That's one of the things that you see amongst fish. They'll go on eating until they kill themselves. So what I'm saying is hunger is a negative experience. If you eat, you bring yourself back to the point of zero. You try to eat more than that, again, you go down. Sleep is like that, right? You're tired. It's a negative experience. So you go to bed. You sleep. You know, if you try to sleep more than what you need, right? Again, it's a negative experience, right? You start getting a backache, crazy dreams, you know, all these things happen. Sex life is like that. Defending ourselves is like that. You know, for most of us, defending ourselves means putting a roof over our heads, right? So, you know, you want to, you have all these bills. You got to pay your mortgage payment, your insurance payment, your electric, your gas, your water payment, your, you know, medical insurance, your car payment to get back and forth to work. You need money for food. You got to pay for gas, right? All these different things, kids in school, on and on and on. So it's a big anxiety. So it's a negative experience. Now, if you go to work, you can bring yourself back to the point of zero, right? Where, okay, I've got enough money to pay my bills, right? But if you go on working, I mean, how many hours are you going to work? You're going to work 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day, 15, 16, 18 hours a day? It just goes on and on. It's just a negative cycle. You just go from zero to negative, back to zero, back to negative. And for the mind, it means gaining a sense of superiority over others. My religion's better than yours. My education is better than yours. I make more money than you. I live in a better house than you. I got a better car than you. I'm smarter than you. I can always get over on you. It's just a negative experience. You're insecure because you know you're so many things are happening in your life that you don't like. But you feel like if you can get over, if you can prove to yourself that you're better than other people, well, you can say, at least I'm not suffering as much as him. At least I'm not as stupid as he is. So I'm better off. So now I'm happy. That's a negative experience. There is a psychological study of violence and violent television. Why do people like to watch violence, right? Because when you watch a movie, what are the two things in the movie? It's will she or won't she, right? It's sex or it's violence, right? The two cars are chasing, right? And the guy behind is shooting with his machine gun, right? And the guy, suddenly his car explodes and he drives through the rail and the car blows up, right? I mean, that's all you're watching, really, is violence and sex. So, you know, they asked, there was a study done on it, and the reason people enjoy violent television, even children's cartoons, right? Like if you watch Superman or Batman or something, right? It's like, oh no, the Joker, you know, he just blew up the bank and killed a bunch of people and stole all the money. Call Batman. And then Batman comes and kills the Joker. You watch children's cartoons, right? And that's all you'll see is violence in the name of doing good, right? You never see Batman go and talk to the Joker and try to analyze what's wrong and what's right and how to become a better person. All you see is Batman run there with the most latest technology of weapons and just fight with Joker and hopefully put him in prison or kill him. So gaining a sense of superiority over others for the mind and then eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. It's all negative. You go basically to the point of zero and negative back and back. And because you can never be the greatest of everything. You cannot be. You can maybe be very good at something. You know, you have some special quality ability. You cannot be the greatest of everything. That's ridiculous. But that's what people are being told. That's what's being trained. And we're influenced by that. And it damages all of our relationships because of that. So where's the happiness? There's nothing positive there. Sense gratification, being a controller, being an enjoyer, there's no, you're not going into the plus area. You're just going negative to zero, until you just go crazy. Or you just sedate yourself, drinking and taking drugs. Americans spend $5 trillion a year on beer to sedate themselves because they're miserable. So Krishna consciousness is meant to give us a way to go into the positive, because we're dealing, first of all, with an eternal person who's the supreme, who's all enjoyable, who's all wonderful and loving, and our soul, which is eternal. And it's a relationship based of love, not overlording. Krishna doesn't overlord anybody. He lets us do whatever we want. If you want to go to hell, he'll let you go to hell. If you want to go to heaven, he'll let you go to heaven. If you want to become a dog, he'll let you become a dog. If you want to become a god, he'll let you become a god. If you want to go back to Godhead, he'll let you go back to Godhead. That's what we're getting. So, this verse that we're reading here, there's a lot that can be said about this. I'm just going to finish here. As long as the Supreme Personality of Godhead continues to glance upon nature, you know, they talk about God being omnipotent. Well, one of the things it means to be omnipotent is that God's senses are interchangeable. You don't find that in any other philosophy or religion. That God, he can impregnate through glancing. He can eat by hearing. Right? That's omnipotency. See, but because our Western idea of being a person is limited by the material energy, Prabhupada uses the term anthropocentric, that we think God is like another human being. Anthro means human, right? Centric means putting our human experience, our human limitations in the center of our worldview. So when we look upon God, we think, oh, if God's a person, then he's also limited. So they have such a poor fund of spiritual knowledge that God's form is not like ours. It's similar in shape, but the energy and its abilities are unlimited. So that's what we're being told about today. That this omnipotency of Krishna, just by his glance, he can create not just one universe, countless universes. You know, some people dare to claim to be God, and yet, you know, God, when he breathes out, okay, as Mahavishnu, Mahavishnu is a plenary portion of Krishna, right? Not even the Supreme Personality of God, but a plenary portion. When Mahavishnu breathes out, it takes 311,432,000,000 years. And when he breathes in, it takes the same amount of time. And when he breathes out from the pores of his skin, unlimited material universes are manifest. That's God. Not somebody who can make a little gold trinket appear in their hand, or squeeze your eyeballs and make you see a white light, or, you know, like presently, you know, they have this Kalki avatar in India. Have you guys heard about that? Yeah, so they have the Kalki avatar in India right now. So what the Kalki avatar, and his wife is Lakshmi Devi. So what you do is you go to see the Kalki avatar and you experience unlimited bliss. So, you know, the BBT, they did some kind of news investigation. So when you go to see him, if you go with a group, you pay 5,000 rupees each to see him. If you go alone, you pay 25,000 rupees. Okay, to see him for a minute. So, but before you go in to see the Kalki avatar, they serve you prasad. All right, Krishna Mataji, good morning. They serve you a big feast. So what the BBT found out was that the feast is laced with narcotics. So by the time the people get in to see the so-called Kalki avatar, they're stoned out of their minds. So now he's got a big mansion, and he's got all these teenagers going to see him every day because they all love taking the prasadam and getting stoned. This is the Kalki avatar. Catch him. I mean, you know. It's in the news. But this is the kind of thing, you know. These people are claiming to be God. Come on. God is manifesting unlimited universes from the pores of his skin. Okay, guys. Thank you for your kind attention. Thanks for sitting with me, Chandra. It's really nice of you. And thanks for popping in every day now, Hansa Duda. It's nice to have you here. Okay, all glories to Srimad Bhagavatam. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Gaur Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai.